I want to welcome you to our 35th week through the Word of God, verse by verse, and to the book of Leviticus today, chapter 27. We're going to start in verse 9 in a moment. Book of Leviticus is a rule book for Levites. It's the tech manual for the Levitical tribe, which included the priests. It was to help them to know exactly how to carry out their duties and how to guide the Israelis as a whole in carrying out their worship of God and their lifestyles as the holy nation of God. These things are all happening in the early part of the second year of the Exodus at Mount Sinai as they're getting ready to head off to the Promised Land. And the topic that they're dealing with right now in chapter 27 is vows. And these are presumably voluntary vows, promises made of your own free will that include promising time that you're going to do stuff, or promising yourself or some animal or some property to God's use. And that's why we need some way of understanding what happens if the situations change. What happens if you can't follow through with your original intention? So the first few verses in chapter 27 helped understand the relative value, rated in work done, of different elements of the Israeli society if they were not able to follow through with a vow that had been made by themselves or on their behalf. And so that was kind of the buyout clause, that's the way we'd kind of think of it, of a vow about yourself. You would pay something of equal value in shekels so that the priests and the Levites would at least have that. We understand that from this next part that comes in verse number 9, because the substitution here is about animals promised to be sacrificed. So verse number 9 says, if the vow is an animal that may be offered as an offering to he who is, all of it that he gives to he who is holy. So we're talking about something given to God, but then a situation changes. Verse 10, he shall not exchange it or make a substitute for it, good for bad or bad for good. And if he does in fact substitute one animal for another, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. Now, to our ears, that sounds a little bit contradictory. It's not, though. It's basically saying the general rule is no substitutes allowed, but there is a conceivable example that would be an exception to that no substitute rule. So let me play it out with an example. Let's suppose you are an Israeli that raises cattle, and one of your cows is pregnant with its second young, and it comes into your head, I want to devote this young calf that's coming to God for sacrifice. I don't have to do it, but I want to do it. And then the calf is born, and you look at it, and you go, oh my goodness, that is the strongest looking male calf or female calf. I just can't stand not having that calf grow up and be part of my herd. Well, the answer from the book of Leviticus would be, sorry, you can't substitute. It's not allowed. You have to give it because you made the promise of your own free will to give it. So there's no out for you. But there is an exception. Suppose you're that same guy, but you're not selfish, you're very self-aware that God gives you everything. And so you really want to worship God appropriately. And so you have this animal of yours that you promised the calf from, give birth to a calf, and you look at the calf, and the calf has got issues. It's scrawny looking, it's not as big as it should be. And you're instant reaction is, oh my goodness, I can't be giving some substandard thing like that to God. I want to give something better. So yes, you can substitute a different animal for sacrifice because of your heart being bothered by what came out, but you don't keep the original animal for yourself. You give it as well because you did promise it. So it goes to the Lord's service. The priest can either use it as a draft animal or milk animal, or maybe they can butcher it for their own purposes. But you don't have to give that original animal as the sacrifice if you'd prefer to substitute something else. So you can see from that how you can have the overall rule, no substitutes allowed, but yet there be a reasonable exception to that substitute rule. But it's not really an exception because you're giving an additional animal. That's really what's happening. Verse number 11. Let's talk about non-sacrificial animals in this situation. If it is any unclean animal that may not be offered as an offering to he who is, then he shall stand the animal before the priest. The priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so it shall be. But if he wishes to redeem it, he shall add a fifth to the valuation. So let's suppose what we're talking about now is a donkey. Donkeys are not sacrificial animals. So you promise to God, I'm going to give the baby of this pregnant donkey to the Lord's service. They need a nice draft animal, an animal to carry burdens around. But the donkey is born, and you look at it and go, oh, that's a pretty scrawny looking donkey. I don't think it's going to cut it for the priests. I think I would rather just keep that around my place or maybe sell that on the open market. So you could go to the priest and basically say, this animal was promised to God in a vow. I don't feel like I want to give it. So I would like to buy it back from you for 120% of whatever you think it's worth. And that would be perfectly acceptable because you see, you're trying to make it right. Now, you could be the stingy guy that we used a while ago in our example. You could have this baby donkey born and you go, oh, I need that for a stud donkey. It looks too strong. So you would be expected to go to the priest and say, I want to buy that baby donkey back for 120% of whatever you value it. And you'd be allowed to do that because God has said you can. So you are making sure that you're not stiffing the priests. You're not putting them out in the cold and not following through with something you promised to God you'd give to them. So this section is all about trying to be fair. Let's talk about locations, properties next. When a man dedicates his house as a holy gift to he who is, the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so it shall stand. And if the donor wishes to redeem his house, he shall add a fifth to the valuation price, and it shall be his. So remember that properties outside of the walled cities were part of the inheritance line. And you could lease them, not really sell them, for the use of other people. Well, if you got it in your head, you wanted to just donate one of these properties to the use of the priests or the Levites that live in your neighborhood, you could do that. But if at some point you changed your mind and you decided, I really do kind of need control of that property back again, then you could go to the priests, the Levites, and say, I'd like out of that vow of donation. And you would then have to pay 120% of the value assigned to the use of that property in order to get it back into your control, because you don't want to stiff the priests. They're working on your behalf, representing you to God and God to you. And so you want to be fair. Now, it's not just houses to live in that you might do this with. It might also be cropland. So verse 16, if a man dedicates to he who is part of the land that is his possession, then the valuation shall be proportional to its seed. A homer of barley seed shall be valued at 50 shekels of silver. Now, we'll go ahead and deal with this now before we go too much farther. Remember that the land belonged to God. it was designated by him to the different tribal groups, and within those groups to the different families. They will inherit a family farm, and it will be passed down a certain heritage line. So the land belongs to God, but it is utilized by the people within a certain family line. You could lease that property out to someone else, and it would be based on the value of the crops that are grown on that property. And it's all based on the Jubilee cycle, the 7 times 7 sabbatical year cycles. So 50 years, basically, 49 plus the one Jubilee. So the valuations of properties are always hooked into how much crop can be gotten out of this piece of property during this specific period of time. And that's the value of the property. It's its lease value. Now, we've got an additional assistance here that says that one homer of barley seed for sowing, that is the stuff that you're going to use to put in the ground to grow a crop, should be valued at 50 shekels of silver. Now, 50 shekels of silver, that's 100 days' wages, as best I can tell. And so that seems way overpriced for one homer, which is 7.26 bushels of barley seed. But it's not the intrinsic value of that seed that we're looking at. We're actually looking at how much of a crop could that amount of seed produce by harvest time. And so just using Jesus' parable of the sower as our example, we know that good land could produce 30, 60, and in a really good year, 100 times whatever was planted in it. So in that case, just using the middle range, this one homer of barley seed might produce 60 homers of harvest seed. And that's 435.88 bushels. That's a lot of grain to be used for human consumption. And so that's what the 50 shekels of silver value is representing, the harvest from this amount. So that's kind of the rule of thumb for evaluating how much is a piece of property worth. All right, so we have a guy, he has a field, he's not using it, he isn't selling it to somebody else to use. Instead, he gets it in his mind, I would rather my local Levites or local priests make use of this property. So you vow it to God for the use of the priests and Levites. Well, verse 17, if he dedicates his field from the year of Jubilee, the valuation shall stand. But if he dedicates his field after the Jubilee, then the priest shall calculate the price according to the years that remain until the year of Jubilee, and a dedication shall be made from the valuation. Technical language here for basically wherever you're at in the Jubilee cycle, that's how much this piece of property is worth. How many crops of how much valuable can be harvested from here in the remaining working years until the next Jubilee. That's what makes the piece of property value standard. And all of this is being brought up at this point because what if the guy changes his mind and he'd rather get that piece of property back for his own use? Well, if he's going to do that, he needs to pay the priests and Levites for what remains of the lease period. And it's not just simply the value of the crops themselves. He has to pay an additional penalty. Verse 19, if he who dedicates the field wishes to redeem it, then he shall add a fifth, that's 20%, to its valuation price, and it shall remain his. But if he does not wish to redeem the field, or if he sold the field to another man, it shall not be redeemed anymore. And this is an interesting exemption here to the normal standard. If you dedicated your field to the Levites and you didn't redeem it previous to the year of Jubilee, it apparently became permanently Levitical property. So you had to get it out of their control if you wish to keep it in your family use, or you wished somebody else to be able to use it, and then it would revert to you in the time of the Jubilee. But the field, when it is released in the Jubilee, shall be holy gift to he who is, like a field that has been devoted, the priest shall be in possession of it. So that's the line I was just talking about. If the year of Jubilee rolls around and it's in the possession of the priests and Levites, it's theirs permanently. It doesn't revert like we'd been talking about in the earlier passages. Let's see, verse 22. If he dedicates to he who is a field that he has bought, which is not a part of his possession, then the priest shall calculate the amount of the valuation for it up to the year of Jubilee, and the man shall give the valuation on that day as a holy gift to he who is. Now, this is a protection of other people's rights. You might have leased from someone else a piece of property, and then you turn around and dedicate that piece of property to the use of the Levites. And then year of Jubilee rolls around. If it had been your piece of property, it would belong to the Levites. But because you had originally leased it from someone else, it goes back to them, because they didn't give you permission to hand that piece of property over to the Levites. It's not your choice to make that permanent donation. So fairness all around is a lot of what we're finding here in this part of the book of Leviticus. Every valuation shall be according to the shekel of the sanctuary. 20 gerahs shall be make a shekel. They didn't use coins at this time yet. That comes much later in history. They used weighted pieces of metal. And there was a standard weight of a shekel. And the sanctuary is the keeper of that standard weight. Everybody else was supposed to attune their weight system to the sanctuary shekel weight system. That's what verse 25 is all about. We have bureaus of weights and measures and things in our modern day society that are held out by the government. They're the ones that monitor it and make sure that the standard never changes. Back at this time, though, the priests and the Levites, they were the ones that protected the shekel as being the proper standard for weight. All right, we've talked about people, we've talked about properties. Let's talk about animals again. But a firstborn of animals, which as a firstborn belongs to he who is, no man may dedicate it, whether ox or sheep. It is he who is this. So you can't dedicate to God that which already belongs to him. Every firstborn animal automatically belonged to God and was slated for sacrifice at some point, if it were a sacrificial animal. Now, if it were not a sacrificial animal, there is this, verse 28. No devoted thing that a man devotes to he who is, of anything that he has, whether man or beast, or of his inherited field, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy to he who is. So even non-sacrificial animals that would not normally be devoted to God, once it was, it belongs to God. It was not to be sold to somebody else. It belongs to God. If you want to redeem it, then you have to follow the redemption procedures we already read about. Verse 29 becomes important as they get ready to go into the promised land. No one devoted who has been devoted to destruction from mankind shall be redeemed. He shall surely be put to death. Israel as a nation is going to act as God's sheriff in an eviction procedure. The people living in Canaan, the Canaanites, have had more than 500 years by now, since the time of Abraham, for their sin to mature, to become worse. And it is so bad that God is now going to evict them from the country. and give that land and all the properties in it over to the Israelis. And the Israelis are being warned, when you go in there to act as the sheriffs in this proceeding, you cannot take money from Canaanites to spare their evictions or their execution, because if they won't leave, then they will be executed. That's the way that it's going to work during what we typically refer to as the conquest of Canaan. It's actually the eviction of Canaan. So no buying out of the judgment that is about to come from God through the hands of the Israelis. Verse number 30, every tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, it is he who is this. It's holy to he who is. If a man wishes to redeem some of his tithe, he shall add a fifth to it. So one-tenth of the crop every year automatically belonged to God. And it was supposed to be a sort of random designation. And we're going to see that randomness when it's applied to animals in a moment. So when you gave a tenth of your fig crop, or a tenth of your olive oil crop, or a tenth of your grape crop, or your wine crop, you just randomly put up one-tenth of whatever physical things you had in that category. And that automatically belonged to God. Now, you might, though, run into the same problem we talked about earlier. Maybe you're a person of great conscience, and you've noticed that the grapes that you're giving or the figs that you're giving are kind of substandard. It was random, and it really wasn't the better-looking ones that ended up going to God. And so you feel bad about that, so you say, I would rather give a different tenth out of my crop, where I pick it. Well, if you do that, that's fine. But now you need to give 120% of that original tithe so that you have the right of substitution. And same would apply if you're trying to make sure you get the best stuff. You want to take the better things out of the random marks. You're going to have to pay 120% in order to be able to do that. So fairness, again, is the idea. Here's the randomness that I was talking about. Verse 32, it's illustrated. Every tenth of herds and flocks, every tenth animal of all that passes under the herdsman's staff shall be holy to he who is. One shall not differentiate between good or bad, neither shall he make a substitute for it. And if he does substitute for it, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. So you can kind of picture him here. It comes tithing time. And so you run all of your animals, not including the firstborn ones, because those automatically belong to God. But you run all the other of your animals through a little narrow place, and you've got a stick, and you're marking every tenth one. This is my tithe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. This is my tithe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. This one's my tithe. And so you've marked them randomly as they're going through this gated system. And then you get up together all of the marked animals. That's the tithe you're going to take to God during the Feast of Tabernacles. But you get to looking at it. And maybe you're the stingy guy. And you're going, man, those are all my strong animals. I don't want to give those. I want to keep those as breeding stock. So, sorry, not allowed. That's just the way it works. You don't get to substitute. But what if you are the person of the great conscience and you look at these and you're going, man, some of those are some of my scrawniest animals. I don't want to give that sort of animal to God as my tithe. You would be allowed to substitute. But even when you did that, you still had to give the original animal because the mark fell on it as the random counting was happening. And that would be fine if you want to give even more than what you would normally give. Now, there also might be the potential that you would be late in giving a tithe. Let's suppose you had a year that things were kind of tight and rough. And so in that particular year, you didn't feel you could give the tithe like you normally did. Well, in that case, you would make up for it the following year. Whatever you'd shorted in your tithe, you would give plus 100, you'd give another 20% over and above that, because you're wanting to keep your relationship with God above board, clear, and representative of your heart, that you really want God to understand how much you're thankful to Him for what He does in your life. Now, the reason I bring that up is because I actually had somebody come to me not too long ago, and they wanted to know about practicing tithing in the New Testament period. Of course, there's nothing in the New Testament that demands New Testament believers have to tithe. It is my opinion, however, that we shouldn't let the Old Testament believers go ahead of us in their worship. So I think we New Testament believers should give at least 10% of our gross to God. That seems to me to be the proper way of representing our thankfulness to the one who loved us and gave Himself up for us. But what if this is what the guy asked? What if I can't really give that full tithe right now? Is God going to be okay with that? And my response was, well, we have this principle in the Old Testament that if something like that were to happen, that in the future, when you felt you could make up for that, that you should add another 20% above that to kind of show God that you really wanted to give it at the time, but you couldn't, and that you'd do this voluntarily. So I think this is one of those times where maybe we can use Old Testament principles as New Testament procedure, not turn it into law, not turn it into some sort of you must do this to be saved, but rather just as kind of the standard to look at as how we can really do things above board in a way that shows we're devoted to being fair in all circumstances and situations, whether we're dealing with other people or dealing with God. Of course, that's just my opinion, so I'd be interested in hearing from you if you want to talk about that topic. Well, let's get back into the Word tomorrow.